Good evening or afternoon, depending on what coast you're joining us from today. Welcome to Mito Action's roundtable discussion with Dr. Catherine Chatfield, Director of Cardiac Genetics Clinic at Children's Hospital Colorado. Tonight, Dr. Chatfield will share with us updates on cardiomyopathy, diagnosis and management, and FAOD. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm a parent of a teen with LCHAD and one of the patient support coordinators at Mito Action, and I'll be your host for this evening. Tonight's discussion will be recorded and available on the Mito Action website in the coming days. The space is a little different than our traditional expert series. We set this call up as a Zoom meeting, which means that you have both video and audio access. We encourage you to turn your videos on if you would like, but please keep yourself muted throughout the presentation, as this will give us all a little bit more of a pleasurable experience. If you have any questions throughout the presentation, please feel free to put them in the chat and I can ask them at the end of today's presentation. Or if you'd prefer, you may raise your virtual hand after the presentation and I can call on you and you can ask your own question. So without further ado, let me officially introduce Dr. Catherine Chatfield. Dr. Chatfield is an associate professor of pediatrics cardiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the director of the Cardiac Genetics Clinic. Her degrees are from Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth and Dartmouth College. She completed a combined pediatrics genetics residency at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and her pediatric cardiology fellowship at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Dr. Chatfield's clinical interests include Noonan spectrum disorders, Marfan syndrome and related connective tissue disorders, familial congenital heart disease, metabolic and inherited forms of cardiomyopathy. Her research focus is the role of mitochondrial energy metabolism in pediatric cardiomyopathy and heart failure. Dr. Chatfield, I really, really appreciate you taking the time this evening to join us and to share with us your wisdom and knowledge. You were just really helpful in understanding everything cardiac. I remember the first time I saw your presentation, and it was just so helpful. You break things down very well. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, for the invitation to come and talk to you guys about a little update on cardiomyopathy and diagnosis and management in FAOD. I just will disclose that I've done some consulting for some companies that develop therapies for FAOD, including Stealth, Ultragenyx, and BioMarin. So Stephanie already mentioned, I'm trained both in pediatric cardiology and genetics, and I do heart failure and heart transplant. So I take care of patients who have heart muscle problems. And I've done more basic science research and clinical research in metabolic disorders. And while I do kind of a range of genetics and cardiology things, metabolic disorders and FAOD are really like my fave. So I'm happy to talk about it anytime. So I'm going to talk to you today. Just this is sort of an overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to try and make it kind of case-based. I'm going to talk about a couple of patients that kind of illustrate different ends of the spectrum of what things can look like in FAOD. I'm going to really spend a very brief amount of time on like the basic concepts of what cardiomyopathy is. So cardiomyopathy, just I'll abbreviate as CM, but we're mostly going to talk about something called dilated cardiomyopathy and something called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but there's lots of different types, and the FAOD type can sort of be a mix or a morphing type that I'll talk a little bit more about. I will talk a little bit about like the mechanisms, which means like why do people with FAOD get cardiomyopathy? And then a little bit about like why some don't, although we don't know as much about that. And then talk about treatment. So really from a conventional therapy, like how a cardiologist approaches heart muscle problems, that's the same way that we will really approach any patient with FAOD. But there are FAOD specific treatments, and many of you are probably familiar with those. So we'll talk a little bit about C7 or Dojolvi and talk about some other future treatments and things that are more investigational. And I'm going to talk about natural history because I think understanding what that means, like understanding what happens in the life of a person is really important and something that we just don't know enough about. So I will move on to talking about my first case. So this first case is an infant that was diagnosed in the newborn period with VLCAD, so very long chain acylcholine dehydrogenase deficiency. This infant was the second child in his family. He has an older brother who's healthy and has no known metabolic disease. He was in the newborn nursery for a short period of time, and there was concern that he might have had a hypoglycemic seizure-like episode, but he was feeding well and kind of recovered from that, so he was discharged home. And then on day of life four, his newborn screen returned in our state and was concerning for VLCAD. So he was admitted to a NICU, our NICU, to both get treated for some jaundice and also to get evaluated and make sure that that he was healthy and feeding, and got started on a special formula of EMFAPORT, which is a low-fat diet with medium-chain triglycerides, or MCT. These parents are distantly related, and when we did further genetic testing, we found that this infant had a truncating mutation, which means he had a mutation that caused the protein not just to have a spelling mistake in the protein, but to have something that stops or cause premature stop of the translation or production of the protein. And so we would presume, based on that genetic information, that he could have a more severe manifestation. And because of that, he was watched really closely in the first year of life to monitor him for cardiomyopathy, which is something that we are concerned about if you know you have a severe deficiency of VLCAD. He had a lot of echoes in the first year of life, but really no major illnesses, and a few short hospitalizations just to kind of make sure that he got IV glucose and adequate nutrition to help kind of get him through some early illnesses. The second patient I'm going to use as an example is another infant that had that was the first child in his family who had a newborn screen that was consistent with LCHAD. He was also admitted to the NICU based on this screen. Had a little bit of jaundice as well, but was feeding pretty well. He was mainly breastfed and had some, and was prescribed a formula that also, again, was a low-fat formula with MCT. He had a variant of normal on his echo, which is something called a PDA, but otherwise the muscle and the function of the muscle was normal. And then a little bit later on, after his discharge, their genetic testing results came back, which showed that he had one copy of the pathogenic variant that's most common in LCHAD, the E510Q. And then he had another variant so his other copy was a variant of unknown significance. So that made it a little like less clear about how, what the severity would be, or what type of LCHAD he might have. So we're going to go over just the basics of what's cardiomyopathy and how that pertains to fatty acid oxidation disorder. So in the normal cardiac anatomy, just to review that, this is the right side of the heart, and this is the left side, as if you're looking at a person from the front. So the right atrium is the side that collects blood from the body when it's ready to be reloaded with oxygen. It goes through the first valve. So valves are just the doors that go from one chamber to the next, so that blood generally goes forward and doesn't leak back. The right ventricle sends the blood out to the lungs through the pulmonary arteries. Once that blood is nice and oxygenated from the lungs, it comes back to the left side, and the left atrium goes through another valve, the mitral valve. And then this left lower chamber is the strongest pumping muscle, the left ventricle, which then sends the blood out the exit door of the aortic valve into the aorta, which is the highway that delivers blood to the body. So in the normal situation, the heart muscle, the left muscle is usually a little stronger. It's developmentally a little different from the right heart muscle, but it has a particular size and like a particular thickness that we're used to looking at, which looks kind of like this diagram. And then there's, kind of two ends of the spectrum of cardiomyopathy. Although there's many other types, these are the ones we're going to focus on. There's one called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is when the heart muscle gets thickened, abnormally thickened. When you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, there's actually not a problem with the squeeze. That muscle, if anything, can squeeze a little extra vigorously, so it can have good systolic or squeezing function. The problem can sometimes be more that it doesn't relax normally, which is called diastole. So there's abnormal diastolic or relaxation function. In dilated cardiomyopathy, that sort of looks a little different. That is the situation in which the heart muscle, often the whole heart, is enlarged, and the muscle walls are more thin, and the chamber is more enlarged. And that's really a disorder of squeeze. So that thin, kind of flabby muscle doesn't have normal squeeze and does not deliver blood flow enough cardiac output to the body when it gets very severe. So the interesting thing about metabolic disorders in general, but especially in FAOD, is that you can go from having normal heart muscle to having a hypertrophic look, and that can evolve over time into a dilated cardiomyopathy, or it can kind of look like both at the same time. And with appropriate therapy and nutrition, you can actually revert back to something that looks more normal. So there can be sort of a waxing and waning. So you can go from having a fairly normal heart to having cardiomyopathy, and then you can, essentially go back to normal. Although oftentimes when you've been sick and you've had cardiomyopathy, especially if you've had it multiple times, it's less likely that you're going to recover back to normal. So I'm going to give some examples along the way of what echocardiograms look like, because I think pictures are worth a thousand words. But we do use other testing modalities that are really simple and give us a lot of information, like chest X-rays, and EKGs are actually extremely valuable for in cardiology, pediatric cardiology in general, but especially in fatty acid oxidation disorders. This is an example of what a normal echocardiogram looks like. So again, look at like the diagram I just showed you. This is the right side, and this is the right side is on the left, and the left side is on your right, looking at the picture. And this picture is a little bit more anatomically intuitive because you can see all four chambers, and you can see the two valves that go from the upper to the lower chambers. An echocardiogram, I'm gonna stop this because it's kind of glitchy. An echocardiogram is basically when you're taking these different slices through the heart, so you can look at the heart in different cross sections. So the four chamber is when you cut through, just like this picture, and you can see the four chambers. But we make other cuts in different orientations that just allow us to look at the heart muscle in different ways. So this is another example. This is when you cut right across the muscle, you can get what's called a short axis, and so you can see the heart in cross section. And the left ventricle really is kind of bullet shaped. It has kind of a ringing motion. That's how it squeezes. And the right ventricle actually sits on top of it in the chest and is more crescent shaped. So this is what a short axis looks like. And on the right on this slide, that is an example of how chest X-ray can be sort of useful, because just looking at the silhouette or the shadow of the heart in a normal child, the silhouette of the heart shouldn't really take up more than the half of the width of the chest. But just looking at a chest X-ray, like in this child, you can see that this heart looks like it's much wider than half the width of the chest. And this is what we call cardiomegaly. So that doesn't tell you what the heart muscle is doing. It just tells you that the heart is large in the chest. And that should lead you to want to do more investigation, like an echo. So some of these tools are really helpful. Even in patients with cardiomyopathy, an X-ray can be useful to kind of understand what's going on. So another example here of what the four chamber picture looks like. Oops. And if you take the heart on a side, like this diagram above, so this picture, you basically just flip it on its side. This is what's called a long axis, and you're seeing the left heart lying down on its side with the right heart above. And this is just an example of what a normal heart squeeze looks like in that orientation. Okay, so what a dilated and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy look like? So really, echo is the way that you make these diagnoses, but there are obviously other lab tests that are really helpful for us, and I'll make mention of them a little bit later. Like a BNP or an NT-proBNP is a hormone or protein that's released from the heart when it's under stress, or more when it has more tension or it's stretched. And while it doesn't give you a diagnosis by itself, and it can be influenced by a variety of physiologic factors in the body, it's very useful for tracking in patients that we know have heart failure or who have cardiomyopathy. And of course, we look at lots of other lab tests to kind of understand what's going on in a patient, like how is this affecting other functions of organs in their body, like their liver or their kidneys. And in a patient with metabolic disorder, obviously there are other things that we might pay attention to that we wouldn't necessarily in other patients without metabolic disorders, like their CK. So in the bottom, this is an example of two short axes echocardiograms. The one that's moving right now is a patient with a dilated cardiomyopathy. So you hopefully can appreciate that this This chamber looks that the black part, the blood looks large, and the muscle's really not squeezing very well. It's jiggling a little bit, but you have very poor squeeze in this dilated cardiomyopathy, and the heart muscle looks sort of thinned. Then on the other side, this is an example of what a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy looks like. So in the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, see if I think my computer's having a little bit of a seizure, but there, it's you can should be able to tell here that this muscle looks much thicker, and when you get to the end of the squeeze, the cavity itself is almost obliterated. So you are able to squeeze almost all the blood out of the heart, but that's not really normal. It shouldn't look like that. So the size of the heart itself looks different from the one on the right. The heart size is not that big, but the muscle is very thick and maybe sort of getting in the way of itself. So those are just examples of what those things look like to us by echo. In a couple definitions and things that I would like to say about cardiomyopathy, and this is a lot of words on this slide, but it's really important because some of these terms are sort of confusing. But essentially, cardiomyopathy means that the heart muscle looks different. It doesn't look normal. And again, we have to qualify what that means, like what type of cardiomyopathy it is. But heart cardiomyopathy is not the same, does not have the same meaning as heart failure. Heart failure is a measure or a metric of symptoms in the patient, and often heart failure can also be accompanied by dysfunction of other organs. So that's important to know because you can have cardiomyopathy and have no heart failure at all. Just because you have cardiomyopathy does not mean you have heart failure. But if you have heart failure, usually it means you have some type of cardiomyopathy. Also, sometimes the signs and symptoms of heart failure are really subtle, and because children can change very slowly over time, it's sometimes hard for parents to see that something is changing with their child and that symptoms are starting to develop, or heart failure may be starting to develop. It can sometimes be pretty sneaky. You can actually children can have moderate or very severe dysfunction with almost no symptoms. They can have really bad dysfunction, and you would not know it until suddenly they just don't compensate. So that's why we have this like edge of the cliff. Kids can have a remarkable capacity to compensate for their heart failure until they don't. And that's the real reason why surveillance and getting echoes is so important, is because we can see subtle changes on these tests long before children actually have symptoms that put them in danger. So cardiomyopathy in FAODs, I'm grouping them all together because in general, all the fatty acid oxidation disorders can have cardiomyopathy that looks, sort of the same. It's not like one type of FAOD has one type of cardiomyopathy and another has a different type. They all have, they can have the same phenotype. But they can have either type, and they can have a mixed type. So they can be thick appearing, they can be dilated appearing at the same time, and one type can sort of morph into another over time, and it can normalize. So it's a very unusual like morphing picture, which is not characteristic for other types of cardiomyopathy in cardiology in general. So there could be variability between types and among patients with particular types of FAOD. Genotype can be predictive. So in the example of the first patient that I gave you, we predicted that that patient would have a more severe phenotype based on his genetics, but we can't always predict that, unfortunately. So functional testing is it would be valuable to help us understand, where children are in the spectrum. But really, predicting who will develop cardiomyopathy is a gap in our knowledge that we don't have that ability pr to predict. And so we really have to treat everybody as if they're at risk, because late onset cardiomyopathy may be something that is more common than we know, especially in the age of newborn screening, where we're picking up more people out in the world at a very early age and treating them virtually from birth. I'm going to just mention very briefly arrhythmia, but I'm not probably going to spend too much time discussing it further, but happy to answer questions later. Arrhythmia or abnormal heart rhythms are very common, and this was one of the things that was kind of well appreciated about cardiomyopathy and heart problems in infants with FAOD when we first started to learn about them back in the 90s. So this is just a list of patients with different fatty acid oxidation disorders and the number of them that had abnormal EKGs. They had a variety of different types of arrhythmias, ventricular arrhythmias, which is what the V stand for, and supraventricular arrhythmias as well. In many of patients, that was the first presenting symptom because that's when they got hypoglycemic or they weren't when they weren't feeding well as an infant, often that was one of the first things that happened to them. And in these very early studies, a lot of these children had, poor outcomes. So this was a small group of patients. It was a long time ago. So it's not really reflective of what we see in the modern era, but it's important for us to remember that this is something that we have to pay attention to and have some concern about, especially in newborns and in patients when they're acutely sick. So just to review quickly what an EKG is, every heart should have a pacemaker, which lives in the upper part of the heart. That's what the P wave is. That's the pacemaker telling the heart to go. That electricity gets down to the middle part of the heart where there's a little time that goes by while the lower chambers are filling with blood. This QRS is the electricity that signals the muscle to squeeze, and then the T is sort of the reset. And the EKG patterns can actually change with sick heart muscle, and they can actually be a really helpful tool for us to monitor patients with FAOD. So getting back to case one, so now this young boy is a toddler. He's had a couple of hospitalizations with no significant rhabdo episodes and no hypoglycemia, but he's got some clues on his echo that maybe he has a little bit of cardiomyopathy. So this may be hard to appreciate, but since I've already showed you a couple of echoes, I'm going to tell you that this muscle, has a slightly thick appearance. Some of these muscles that attach to the valves look a little bit thick. And the function is normal, but it's just not perfect. It just doesn't look perfectly normal. So this patient was doing well, but there were clues on his echo that suggested that, he could be at risk, even though he was doing just fine. Then, when he was about 3 years old, he went through a winter, and winters, kids get a lot of respiratory illnesses. And he'd weathered these illnesses pretty well. His parents were able to continue to feed him his formula through illnesses. He was didn't show any outward signs of any symptoms or fatigue or anything at all. And he came into clinic and he went from having that echo that I just showed you, which is essentially, normal, even though it looks has a hint of something of cardiomyopathy to someone who's trained to look for it. And then within that short period of time, he went from having that echo to having an echo that does not look as good. So this muscle looks a little more thick, and it's not squeezing as well. There's just too much black space in the middle. And this is a different view. This is the four-chamber view again, and it's also faster. So he's more tachycardic because his heart muscle is not as good. And when the heart muscle is not squeezing as well, it compensates by going faster to maintain cardiac output. So this heart was looking like it was in trouble. In spite of that, he was eating and drinking and seemed to be, doing okay with his nutritional regimen. So he was not actually admitted, but at this time we decided to start him on our conventional medical therapy, which we call guideline-directed medical therapy, or some we'd liked cardiologists like jargon, so we call it GDMT. And part of that regimen for him included starting a medication called a beta blocker by the name of carvedilol. Which is one of my favorites for metabolic disorders because it has some properties that may be beneficial to metabolism. So this patient worked with their dietitian, with the metabolic dietitians to maximize his calorie goals and was able to, go home and continue to live his life without having to be hospitalized. Coming back to our second patient with LCHAD, again, we weren't 100% sure what kind of LCHAD phenotype he might have, whether he would be really mild or more typical. He did have a handful of hospitalizations that were really precautionary in the first year of life to just support him, support his calorie needs through illnesses. This child was really active. He's really likes sports, and so he does a number of different sports. And he's had some muscle symptoms when he does sports. He can feel a little tired. Sometimes he had a little bit of elevation in his CK, but his symptoms really were only evident when he was really exercising pretty hard. By this point in his later childhood, he was not really on a strict diet or a formula. He was taking, generally the family just uses a low-fat diet to, maintain his nutritional needs. And these are what his echoes look like. So in comparison to the one I just showed you, hopefully this looks really normal. This heart muscle squeeze is perfect, and the wall thickness looks normal. This is a normal function. So he has no evidence of cardiomyopathy. So why do patients get cardiomyopathy? Well, the heart, it may, be it's obvious when you say it, but you don't always think about it, that the heart needs energy constantly. It's working 24/7. It has a very high energetic need. It needs a lot of ATP. So ATP is sort of the energy currency in our body, and especially in our heart. And your heart synthesizes and uses about 6 kilograms or, pounds of ATP per day. It needs that source constantly. It can never be deficient. So it can't be reliant on glucose, because if you had hypoglycemia and you relied on that source, you'd be in trouble. And so it kind of makes sense that the heart really loves fat, because fat is like a slow, constant fuel that can constantly generate ATP. So the heart likes fat. And the heart likes fat for two different reasons. It likes it, it needs it both for muscle contraction, but also the electrical conduction or electricity, the way that electricity makes the heart pump also requires energy. So our therapies, when we think about how are we going to direct therapies to treat FAOD, they really need to be able to treat both problems, the cardiac muscle, energy problem and the conduction problem. So it's generally been thought that, because medium and long chain fats, they require transporters to get into the mitochondria. They don't just magically get there to do their job. They have to be transported, and then they have to be broken down to produce this end product, acetyl-CoA, which then goes to the TCA cycle, and then it interacts with this other system called oxidative phosphorylation, which is how your body uses oxygen to make ATP. So if you suddenly you have a block here, you're trying to use fat because you're not able to get energy from some other places, then you're kind of stuck, and the heart has basically an energetic failure. Mitochondria, it's just, I like this diagram because it just kind of demonstrates like we think of mitochondria as looking like these little kidney beans in our cell, but mitochondria and the heart are actually kind of fully engulfing the contractile element of the myofibril, or the muscle, the muscle apparatus inside the cell. And that it's that way because that muscle contractile element needs a constant supply of ATP. So it's completely engulfed in mitochondria in the healthy situation. And if you have heart failure and possibly some of these metabolic disorders, then you have deficiency of mitochondria, and the architecture, the way that they live in around the cell, is also not normal. So energetic failure is one mechanism, but there are probably other things going on. So one thing again is that when beta oxidation here is not working, it's not helping to feed some important stuff over to this respiratory chain, which is again where oxygen gets turned into ATP. So you get secondary dysfunction of respiration. Your heart has some flexibility to use other things for energy, but you probably have some loss of that flexibility in heart failure. It may also result in more what's called reactive oxygen, which is oxygen that's very reactive and can kind of damage other proteins and other parts of the mitochondria. And it may be as well, this is another area of research that we're interested, that it affects that you have some dysfunction of this mitochondrial membrane, so that what kind of holds everything together may also be damaged in some of these fatty acid oxidation disorders. So we've learned a lot about this from animal models and have sort of extrapolated or applied it to people, but we actually don't really know a lot about and haven't studied this a lot in people. And this is just my kind of soapbox for, for studying rare disease and investing in rare disease, because even though all of these individual disorders are very rare, when you group them all together, they're a really pretty large population of people. And a lot of the therapies that we use for mitochondrial disease in general can, benefit patients with FAOD and maybe many other types of mitochondrial disease. So as a larger group, there are more significant, can have more significant impact on a larger group of people. Okay, so coming back to our child, one with VLCAD. So after a year of GDMT or conventional cardiology, cardiac, therapies, he actually had pretty much recovery of his function back to what his baseline was. So the squeeze is really good. The muscle looks a little bit thick, but the squeeze is really good. And so the family was really, happy with this, and they really hated having him on medicine. Who wants to have their kid on heart medicine? Nobody. So because he'd had full recovery of his squeeze heart function, his carvedilol therapy was discontinued, and he was eating and doing really well with his diet, and was able to continue to do well without any cardiac therapy. This is our second patient who now has reached adolescence, and I told you that he likes a lot of sports. And so the more involved he gets and the more competitive he gets in sports as an older child and young adolescent, the more bothersome his muscle pain has become. And he's had some more significant episodes of, well, not really fulminant rhabdo, but he's had some more muscle symptoms and periods of time where he's leaking more CK into his blood that we can measure. So that's just really demonstrating as he got older how those spikes in his CK are starting to happen more as he gets more athletic and more involved in sports. So therapies. I'm gonna kind of there's I've got quite a few slides here, but I'm gonna try and go through them sort of quickly because I'm hoping that a lot of this you've heard probably from Dr. Vockley's lectures or Dr. Gillingham's in the past. But so why does some of our therapies, our cardiac therapies that we use in other patients, like why should these help patients with beta oxidation or fatty acid oxidation disorders? Well, beta blockers, what they do is they block the adrenaline signal. They block a receptor in the heart that both tells the heart to squeeze harder and go faster. And that would, seem like maybe you wouldn't want to do that. But in fact, when you have some degree of heart failure or cardiomyopathy, decreasing the heart rate and the contractility decreases the amount of oxygen that the heart needs to use. And it kind of slows down the metabolism so that maybe those mitochondria can catch up a little bit and do a little bit better with their kind of sluggish fatty acid oxidation. It can kind of protect the heart, the cell, from having some damage. Beta blockers, carvedilol in particular, can have some anti-inflammatory and anti-reactive oxygen species effects. They also have been shown to help the heart be a little bit more metabolically flexible. So they might help the heart be a little bit less reliant on beta oxidation, and that may be helpful as well. So some of these properties, which are useful in heart failure in general, may be especially helpful in kids with beta oxidation. And so now I'm going to shift a little bit into talking more about Dojolvi. But before I do that, we just have to say that I've told you that there can be waxing and waning of heart function in FAOD. But in some cases, children obviously have been so impacted by multiple decompensations, and their cardiomyopathy and heart failure may not be reversible. What I meant to say in this point is that in some cases, the therapies that we want to give them and the nutrition that we want to give them, it's not as effective because it's really hard to force feed a kid if they don't have a secured route of nutritional delivery. And that means to say that some children who get a G tube actually do better because we can get more calories into them without having to rely on the child. And some children are not as cooperative with us as we would like for them to be. We use conventional, like the same heart failure therapies that we use for any kid we'd use in kids with FAOD. and that may be helpful in their recovery, but there's some special considerations like nutrition and alternative therapies, which again we're going to come to in a minute. But in some patients that have had total failure, heart transplant may be the only option for those patients. And in some of those patients, they require what this one of our patients had. This is not an FAOD patient, but a patient with a dilated cardiomyopathy who had terminal heart failure as a newborn, and she required this device, which is called a Berlin heart, which is basically a pump that helps do her heart's job for it while she waited for a heart transplant. So all options are on the table for our patients with FAOD. Although if you kind of know about this natural history where they can get better, it might allow us to be a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more patient about while working towards recovery. And this new tool that we have that was FDA approved a few years ago is triheptanone, which most of you probably know about. Biochemical geneticists and genetics providers are really familiar with this new therapy, as are dietitians. But in cardiology, it's sort of a new thing to us. So not as many pediatric cardiologists have familiarity with this. So a partnership with your cardiologist, it can be really helpful to understand how this could be a benefit. In the original one of the trial that Dr. Gillingham and Vockley did, some of you may have participated in it. This is just a kind of review. Talk or you can have these slides. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but essentially a trial was done that compared patients treated with C7 or triheptanone with MCT or an oil that's really similar but has 8 carbons instead of 7 carbons. And it's very interesting that that such a small change in a fatty acid can really potentially have a pretty big difference. So some of the patients in the trial had significant heart manifestations at the time of presentation, but all had normal cardiac function when they were started on the trial, which is important to note. So none of them had, overt bad function at the beginning of the trial. But what they found is that when you compared the triheptanone patients to the ones that got MCT, that their change in ejection fraction, they had more of a change for the better with their LV ejection fraction in the triheptanone group compared to the MCT group. And then the end-systolic volume. So this is actually something you want to be a little bit lower. This wasn't, really statistically different between the two groups, but looked like it was going to be a little bit lower in the triheptanone group. So that's a good thing. Again, this is a wall mass. So you want your wall, you don't want wall mass to be too big. So this group seeming to be a little bit lower in the triheptanone was encouraging. And what they saw from the baseline to even after 4 months was that the patients on triheptanone had a little bit of improvement in their ejection fraction, and there wasn't any change in the group with MCT. So I'm going to skip over some of this, but this information is all published, and we can talk about some of it if it's of interest. But this is just sort of kind of the baseline characteristics. So basically, they took all comers in this trial, lots of different diagnoses from VLCAD, LCHAD, CACT, TFP, and measured the same kind of outcomes in these groups. They were a wide range of ages, so that was kind of an interesting thing about the trial, that there's such variability in age. And then this is again one more example of how, if you look at each of these individual patients, if you looked at their baseline, which is in the dark bar, and then what happened after treatment with triheptanone, their ejection fractions went from sort of low to completely normal. So this is a very, except for in this one patient, he did not follow the rules. This patient did not. I don't know if it's a he. And the function in this patient actually did not look better. So, as with any trial, not everybody is going to totally do what you want them to do or fit the pattern. There's always going to be some outliers, but the vast majority of the patients had a benefit from this. So what does C7 do? So the fatty acids that we get in our diet are, interestingly, they're all odd chains. So 16 to 18 are the lots of the fats that come in our diet, like in oils and olive oil and things like that. They have to get transported into the mitochondria. Then they go through the beta oxidation spiral, where 2 carbons get spit out with each cycle, and those come into the Krebs cycle and into making ATP. And C7 is what's called an anaplerotic substrate. So it's a way that C7 is not natural in the fats and in our diet. It can be produced by bacteria, and we can get it other ways, but it's not something we can easily get in the diet. So it needs to be generated in a different way, but it's able to get into the mitochondria and bypass all of these systems that have, where you can have blocks at different steps based on your diagnosis, and feed into the TCA cycle to give you an alternate energy source, which is, pretty cool. So in the interest of time, I'm gonna skip forward to this, just to say that at the very least, we know triheptanoin is not worse. It's at the very least the same, and the evidence has shown that it appears to be superior to MCT. There's a number of case reports from this country and other countries that have shown that patients with cardiomyopathy treated with triheptanoin have had resolution or normalization. So it may promote or help accelerate the reversible this reversible process. That being said, not every patient with severe cardiomyopathy may have the ability to normalize, and some have died or required a heart transplant. And I would say that triheptanoin is not, again, going to replace all the strategies that we would normally use in children that have heart failure. So coming back to our first case of our VLCAD patient. So this is the kind of trends over time. If you focus in on this one column, this is his left ventricular ejection fraction. So that's just an easy number to track. And this is like a long, this is when he was younger, and this is when he was older. So when he started carvedilol, he had an EF of 40 to 45. And over time, after a year, that completely normalized. But then he started to dwindle again. Like, things started to kind of get a little bit worse for no apparent reason. And so the family at that time, this is near to the time that it was FDA approved, the family began triheptanoin, and he started to have some recovery in his function again, which was encouraging. Until he didn't. So sometime later, he was just, not eating as well and getting sick occasionally. And he just can was getting he was getting his therapy. He was on medical therapy again with the cardiac medications, and he was getting C7, but his heart function just continued to get precipitously worse. And so these are his echoes at that time, which hopefully, oops, you can appreciate that this squeeze looks really not good. And this squeeze in a different view also, the heart looks just really stretched out, and the function is poor. So unfortunately, at this time, the patient had to be admitted to get an NG tube so that he could get adequate calorie nutrition and his C7 and the cardiac therapy, so that he could get better enough so that he could be not a significant risk to go under anesthesia to get a G tube. So we'll come back to him. And our second case, our adolescent with LCHAD, again, we can see that he's having multiple episodes of mild episodes of rhabdo. So also, this patient considered at that time started C7 really to help with his muscle symptoms, even though his heart was normal. So talking a little bit about natural history, what does that mean? Well, I don't want you to, this is a boring table. The reason for showing the boring table is just to show you that, like, lots of what we think we know about FAOD comes from like 25 years ago. Lots of, good studies were done at that time, which told us some information about, like, that a significant number of patients get cardiomyopathy. But this is in the time when newborn screening was not universal, and these therapies were not being used. So, like, what would have happened with these patients now? That's a different question that hasn't been answered. There is a study. So this is, something that concerns a lot of families, but it's really important to just to say that these are all patients with LCHAD that were studied in Dr. Gillingham's study. And this is, they looked kind of at all these patients when they were older. So all these, on the axis down here is how old they are. So they were looking at patients that were in their teens up to their 30s to show, like, well, what happened to them? What were their cardiac, kind of their cardiac situation? And each one of these little colors and shapes is indicates a different outcome. So there were a few patients that had sudden cardiac arrest and sudden death. And in one of these patients, prior to this, there was really no known history of cardiomyopathy because you don't see anything else kind of on their life bar. In some of these other patients, like this yellow one, this patient has had multiple episodes of heart failure kind of along the road that seemed to happen a little bit, more as they got older. But the bottom line is that, we kind of want to pay attention to everyone as they get older because, and think about some of these tests like echoes and Holter monitors because, we just don't know and who's at risk, and we need better tools to be able to assess who's at risk and be able to prevent these kinds of complications. So coming back to our VLCAD patient, so this is a year after a G-tube, and his heart function is completely normalized. So this has been the case for a number of patients who, were started on C7 and didn't really do better. And it's not anybody's fault. It's not the family's fault. It's not the kid's fault. It's just hard to, get some kids to take these terrible medications and formulas that they sometimes have to take. And hard for them to take it in the doses and the frequency that are going to keep them out of trouble. So once this little guy got a G-tube, he still eats primarily by mouth, but it just made managing him and being able to keep him healthy a lot easier. This is what things looked like after his G-tube. So on the top up here, these are CK values. And on the bottom, this is an NT-proBNP. So again, this marker that kind of helps us know, track this patient. So this is when he was really sick. His CK was high, his NT-pro was high. And then with the G-tube and with getting his therapy, things became normal. But then he started to have more rhabdo events because he started to be really active and started to do a ton of stuff. So although his ejection fraction, which you see here, went from 22, which is not good, up to 63 in more recent times, now we've just had to pay more attention to his muscle symptoms because he feels so great that he's exercising a lot and he's having some more muscle symptoms. And our second patient, the one with mild LCHAD, he continues to do sports, but his symptoms are better and he has less muscle symptoms with being on C7 therapy. And then again, this is an example of, how his echo continues to look completely normal, which is great, but we're never not going to have not let him follow up in cardiology. So I guess that should be the message that if you're normal, wonderful, but you should never be discharged from care. Okay, so then some unanswered questions and where we're going to go in the future. And so I'm almost done. I'm trying to rush to the end so there's as much time as for questions as possible. I'm sorry I took up most of your hour. What should your cardiologist be doing? Unfortunately, there's not like a good set of published guidelines that say like, this is what you should do. Here's your checklist. This is what your cardiologist should know and what they should be doing. And that's on me and Dr. Bockley and some other people to try and get, a group of people together to work on that. But, a pretty basic plan of care should be that every patient should get an echocardiogram when they're diagnosed and about every year to just keep track of things. If symptoms happen, then you should be seen sooner and get more types of tests. And EKG is a really valuable, super easy, quick, cheap test. So if you're in the emergency room and you can't get an echo right away, an EKG and some blood work is still can give you may be able to give you all the information you need to know like where to go next. Holter monitors or something called a Zio, which is a patch that can be worn for up to 2 weeks, is really valuable because that allows me to see like what's going on with a kid or an adult. Or young adults. I don't see adults much. It allows us to kind of see what's going on with that heart rhythm when you're not here. And if you're having palpitations or symptoms at home and I just don't happen to catch them when I'm in the office, then this is a valuable way to try and catch that. There's other types of monitors that are used as well. There's something called a loop, which is like an implantable device that can be worn for a few years that monitors heart rate. And then I'm going to put in a little bit of a plug here for something called cardiac MRI. This may end up being something really valuable to monitor, especially older patients who've had or had not had any significant history, because it's able to show us give us more information about the heart muscle and be able to see the heart muscle in more detail than we can by echo. We actually wrote a big grant as part of something called the RDCRN, or the Rare Disease Clinical Consortium Network, to try and study this more. And we're hopeful that that we'll be able to do that type of research sometime to get MRIs on more people and really understand the role for it. But ultimately, your cardiologist and your care team, your metabolism team is going to know you and your child best, and they ultimately are going to make those decisions for you. And we're just going to try and help provide some general guidance. So future therapy, there are other therapies, other antipleuritic medications, ROS scavengers, some alternative metabolic approaches. So I'm gonna, not say too much more about that, because I want to stop talking and let you guys ask some questions. But ultimately, I think some important things that we need to work on are understanding who's at risk, finding some better biomarkers or maybe blood tests that help us know, well, who may have some lurking subclinical heart disease that we're just not able to see, so that we know how to manage them more proactively, and know how important this prevention strategy is versus, reversing problems. Which one is more important, and which one is going to keep our kids and adults healthier for the longer term? Okay, I'm going to stop, and I'm happy to stay on a couple minutes longer if people would like to as well, but I'm sorry for taking up the whole time, and happy to answer any questions.
You don't need to apologize. We appreciate your time so much. And there's absolutely a lot of questions. So you might just have to tell me when you have to go because I want to throw a lot out there. And I think, you just mentioned about the new therapies. I don't know what can you share in regards to alternative metabolism or pharmacology? Because I think that is an area of interest that is definitely in our community in regards to outside of the C7 and beta blockers, are there other things that are being explored or that they should talk to their cardiologist about?
I think there's some other things in the pipeline that I probably can't say too much about. Just know that there are, companies that are interested in exploring some alternative energy, source drugs. And the good news is that some of these strategies may be helpful in the general heart failure population. And so, like, that may, benefit us, because we can say, well, we may be a rare disease, and the general public may not care about it so much, but some of these therapies may actually be beneficial to all ch children with different types of cardiomyopathy or mitochondrial disease, or adults with heart failure. And so we need to sell this as, like, this may benefit, like, a larger, community. There is probably more that we can do to study in our populations. Like, well, do beta blockers really improve outcomes? Like, are there ways that we can study how our usual armamentarium of drugs, like, how which ones of those are going to be especially good for metabolic patients, and which ones are not? Other therapies that have been thought about, there's a medication that's a mitochondrial targeted therapy called elamipretide that was actually being considered for approval for a sort of related condition called Barth syndrome. That one is kind of exciting. I know of a patient that's been on that therapy because she hated being on C7, and she, subjectively has some, seems to have benefit from it, but that, really requires more study. That compound, they were supposed to announce FDA approval or not actually yesterday, and it's been postponed. And so, as of many things in the FDA, so we're hopeful that it will get approved, but we still, I mean, literally it could happen any day. And that may be something that's available to, some patients, especially if you've, like I'd use go to the core this, use beta blockers and C7. Make sure that you're getting adequate daily, calories, and ensure that you're doing the best with what we have already. And then it may be, worthwhile exploring some of these other therapies. But elamipretide is one example of something that could be available in the near future.
So Alex, I do see you're kind of going to call you in a second, but you just mentioned something in regards to being able to utilize what we have available now. And I was curious when you talked about the VLCAD patient that had the G tube placed, do you know if the G tube allowed them to do night feeds? Like if that's something that changed that they're doing more consistently, or if there's other.
I think it did two things. One, he just felt horrible and he didn't want to eat. And so when he had a G tube, we were able to like just trickle in the nutrition to help, him recover. And then to, like when they reach a certain point, then they feel better and then they do fine on their own. But it also allowed them to avoid the overnight fasting. So he went from doing feeds like, over, I don't know, to 8, 10 hours, something like that. And now he doesn't get fed over the entire night, but he at least gets some over the night that prevents like that period of fasting. And that may, that may be some provide some benefit, but I don't think the like time of fasting is not as important as like just consistent daily calorie intake, which is especially hard in young children.
Can you go ahead and unshare your screen so we can see everybody? That might be helpful. And then,
Thanks.
Alex, go ahead. You can go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. I was wondering if you have seen scarring of the heart in FOD patients, and then what your hope would be for cardiac MRIs in the future.
So yeah, I have not seen scar, so we yet, but I haven't been looking enough. And so some things to say about that. Dr. Gillingham, some of Dr. Gillingham's patients and some of Dr. Vockley's patients have undergone cardiac MRI, and so and I'm told that in some patients they have observed something called delayed gadolinium enhancement, which essentially is scar or some it's injury inside the muscle that you would not be able to see otherwise. That is, it doesn't it's not a like mean gloom and doom necessarily, but it does mean that we monitor more carefully for arrhythmias, and it tells us that that heart has had some injury, and you're going to follow that patient differently than if they have nothing at all. So it's being done sort of on a case by case basis, but we haven't collected enough patients, in a systematic way to really know like what all patients with L, if you take like every 20-year-old with LCHAD, how many of them have scar in their heart? Like, we don't know. That was something that we are hoping to study, and we just don't know the answer. But certainly, it's something that I'm going to start doing in older patients. The things to consider that MRIs are expensive. MRIs require that children be still for an hour or longer. So in general, they if they're very young, they would require anesthesia. And so there's and they have to have an IV. There's other considerations. So in general, unless I have a really important reason why I need to do it, I'm going to wait until my patients are in their teens or early adulthood before doing a cardiac MRI and wait for them to not need anesthesia and for it to be more worthwhile.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Go for it.
You said maybe these patients would need to be followed differently. I am one of them, so congrats, you've met one. but I'm just wondering, when you say they need to be followed differently if there is scar, what do I tell my cardiologist?
So I mean, I think that your cardiologist is they should know about it. Hopefully they ordered the test. They should be aware of the outcome of that study. Certainly, and I have to speak in generalized ways because I don't know you and I don't know your particular, your history and situation. But in general, if a patient has a history of any kind of cardiomyopathy and has some DGE on their MRI, then most certainly I'm going to be doing echoes every year. I would be probably doing Holter monitors or that Zio monitor every year to monitor for arrhythmia. And the easier thing in older people is that they can tell you if they have symptoms of palpitations. That's much harder in little kids. They can't necessarily tell you when they have symptoms. I should be able to your rely on you to have symptoms and know when additional testing might be important.
There were some questions that came in the chat about symptoms. Can you talk a little bit about what symptoms might look like for younger kids and for adults? Like, what kind of things should parents and/or I, as a patient, be looking out for that would be concerning?
Yeah, so in little kids, hopefully again you're getting surveillance on a regular basis, but any change in energy level or appetite should always be, kind of a red flag, but those are sort of the same things that you're going to be monitoring for and contacting your metabolic team about anyway. You know, if you have a bad a gastro followed by a URI and, you know, like multiple illnesses, they should be getting labs more often. And they might consider getting an echo earlier if you've, you know, been through a series of illnesses. But it's also like very context, you know, specific. So anybody who's had a history of anything cardiac is going to be like, you know, you are going to be much more vigilant with that patient than someone who's never had, you know, any history at all. So, I mean, you kind of have to rely on your intuition because kids that, you know, those symptoms can be really subtle. They're generally, it's rare and it's unlikely that their heart disease is going to manifest as chest pain or, you know, passing out. But certainly like those things would, you know, we would never ignore. It's harder for me to speak to symptoms in adults, but the main thing that I would that I am attentive to or listening for in adult patients is palpitations, heart racing, or feeling like they're going to pass out. Of course, because some of our patients know about all these things, they're anxious, and so you know sometimes that some of that may be muddied by, you know, anxiety about these things. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, our adult patients are mostly like, you know, totally normal people who know their bodies really well. And it's important that you listen to your body. And if something doesn't feel right, that you let your cardiologist know, or you get to an ER if something feels really not right. Just, you know, trust yourself and your body and how you feel.
Some questions have come through the chat in regards to blood work because you mentioned that, and some of our families, I know they get their troponin levels checked, and you also mentioned NT-proBNP. Can you explain how monitoring troponin or the NT-proBNP, how that works? Like, what does that tell you as a cardiologist, and how often, you know, would it be something to consider to follow? Because, you know, for most of our families, we get that our kids or ourselves get blood work already, you know, like once or twice or three times a year. So if you just need to throw another one in, sometimes it's like no harm, no foul, depending on what's going on. But what do you see when you see those things come through?
So I don't get troponins very often. It's certainly something a lot of people do. It's just it doesn't. I would only expect it to maybe be abnormal in the setting of like you know metabolic crisis or fasting. So it's something that I would you know more check in the context of when you're really worried that somebody's sick, not like when they're well, like. It's not something we usually cardiologists generally use for routine monitoring, so that's why I don't get it very often. And our patients are not like really ill in the hospital very often, so I just don't get it that often. And NT-proBNP, like I showed you that trend, like that tracked with this patient's function. So it's just another piece of information that helps me know that he's recovered or maybe he's getting worse. And it's not perfect because there's not normative values for really young infants. It can be elevated sometimes when you have something else going on, like a respiratory illness. So it's helpful when you know that what the patient's baseline, a person's baseline is, then it can be helpful to kind of track over time. And it's just easier, like it's easier to get a blood test sometimes than it is to get an echo. So if you're in an emergency room in Winnipeg or something, and like you have symptoms and like they're not really able to give, you know, do an echo or some workup, then sometimes some of these blood tests will and an EKG is going to provide, you know, a quick way to just help make sure that there's not an immediate heart concern. So, like you said, because most of these patients are, Stephanie, are getting lab work on a regular basis anyway, like you know, I don't always get it routinely in really young kids who have no history. But once they start getting a little older, it's nice to have a baseline. And I'll get it when they're getting blood work anyway, about once a year. So, a BNP really, again, tells you that whether the heart's under, you know, essentially you can think of it as under stress. A troponin is a protein that leaks out of the muscle when there's muscle injury. So in general, when you're walking around in a well state, I've never heard of, you know, a metabolic patient just having, you know, leakage of troponin. It can happen in some metabolic disorders. It's just not something I've seen in FAOD, outside of the context of like, you know, being really ill or potentially in a heart failure exacerbation.
So if you're having an episode of rhabdomyolysis, would that be a time that your troponin
It
you would have
can.
issues, but not necessarily?
Right. Not necessarily.
Okay.
But if you're worried and and again, you don't have access to it, or you just want some reassurance that the heart muscle is not involved in that rhabdo episode, that's an easy test to do.
One patient said that their prolonged PR and prolonged QT are being lumped together as an LCHAD thing and not really concerning to their cardiologist. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Thinking of it generally speaking.
Depends, and it's hard to say because there's variability in the population. So a prolonged PR, and it depends on their age. It depends on a number of things. QT interval is a little bit more of a something I pay more attention to because it's more correlates with muscle health, muscle or muscle disease, and it can be more of a clue about getting into danger, especially if it's changing over time. So it depends on, if you started normal and it's gradually getting longer over time, then that would give that be something I pay a lot more attention to than if you have like a borderline QT as a woman and it's always been like that, because that just may be who you are. Because women can have a longer QT than men, and some women have a longer than average QT. So sometimes it's hard to know if that's related to LCHAD or not, but I care more about like what's happening over time. And like, how long it really is, because, 455, I don't really, that's, I'm not really, or 460, I don't care about. If it's 500, like, that's really abnormal. So it kind of depends.
So, do you view long QT as a symptom or like
I view it,
as, yeah.
yeah, in general, as something that correlates with muscle disease. And if there's no muscle disease and you have a long QT, I might go barking up other trees. Because I haven't seen that, at least in FAOD. That's different for organic acidemias, but in FAOD, I have not seen isolated long QT in the absence of any, muscle or any history of cardiomyopathy. So if it's just a thing by itself, I might wonder if there's other factors. There's lots of drugs that affect the QT as well. So like when somebody has a long QT, there's lots of things that you have to think about.
Okay, that's really helpful. That's really helpful to know.
Antidepressants like Zofran, like if you're getting Zofran all the time, your QT is going to be really long. It's a complicated question because there's lots of things that impacts the QT, and a lot of those things may be relevant to, FAOD people.
No, but that's really helpful because then maybe it's important for patients to then ask the question like, well, why, right? Like, is it just my LCHAD or like or could it be other things and explore that with their doctor? Can we, one patient asked, is tachycardia common in FAODs and is that an indicator that we need to watch more closely?
Depends on what kind of tachycardia. My answer to every question is going to be it depends. So it depends on like how, like what that means. Is it like little bursts of tachycardia, or are you just sort of like tachycardic all the time? And like how tachycardic? So there's normal tachycardia, which can be, some people just may have a higher heart rate. Their baseline might be higher than other people's. But if it's something that's changing over time, that can be concerning. Or if it's, related, if it's a pathologic tachycardia that happens in like spurts, like, that's something that's a little bit more concerning perhaps. So it depends on, what you mean by that exactly. But I guess somebody who's just at baseline has a higher rate, I might, be paying a little bit more attention to that and trying to figure out why.
And you mentioned the heart monitor, and I know sometimes those are used to evaluate issues of tachycardia. Is there, and I guess this is going to be another depend question, but like as you're trying to explore, like with your cardiologist, like how long to keep the heart monitor on, what is maybe a typical range or like, and how do you as a cardiologist decide how long to keep the heart monitor on, like a 72-hour versus, 3 days versus a couple weeks? How do you make that decision?
It's so part of it is like sometimes you say it depends on the frequency of symptoms. So if you're doing it because someone has symptoms and they have symptoms every day, well, your chances of catching it by doing a 72-hour monitor are pretty good. But if you're only having symptoms once a week, then it's going to be, my chances of catching that are a little bit lower. So I might use a monitor that you wear for longer because I want to watch for a longer period of time. If there's, any history of any abnormality at all, I just might make the longest use of the Zio you can wear for 2 weeks. So I'll just tell patients, wear it as long as you can or till it falls off and you can't put, and it's not going to be put back on. I just like as much information as possible because it costs the same whether you wear it for 2 days, a Zio, versus where you wear it for 2 weeks. The cost is no different. If you're talking about, so their Holter monitors are, again, ones that are different from a Zio. Those are usually a 24 or a 48-hour monitor, where we don't use them as much anymore. But if you're having like daily symptoms, that may be adequate because you just want to catch a person ideally when they're having symptoms. If they're not having symptoms and you're just doing it for monitoring, then I generally would do it, again, for longer, just so I have a bigger window into like, what's going on when you're out in the world living your life, not in my office.
For your FAOD patients, do you generally recommend an annual echo or EOG, EKG? And then does it need to be more frequent with puberty?
It doesn't necessarily need to be more frequent with puberty unless unless you have you already have cardiomyopathy. So yes, during puberty because you have more catabolism, like you're burning more energy, you have more calorie demand. So certainly there are, time periods like in toddler times when you're just sick, when they're sick all the time, that's a higher risk time. Adolescents can be higher risk because growth and hormones are really, making you burn more energy. So, and it's hard to meet that demand sometimes. So I wouldn't necessarily increase the frequency, but it depends on the patient. If they already have cardiomyopathy, like my VL-CAD patient who, has a history of having a couple episodes of really pretty significant dysfunction, yeah, sure, I might see him twice a year in during growth spurts. But for my other LCHAD patient who's been really stable and he's on C7 for muscle symptoms, I think still seeing him every year would be totally adequate.
Would you expect to still see episodes of SVT if taking Dojolvi?
Yeah, I mean SVT, there are different types of SVT. Sometimes SVT is there because of like a short circuit in the heart, and just being on Dojolvi isn't necessarily going to suppress that. Like sometimes it's like, and sometimes it may be something that happens because you have a little scar that forms in the con that creates that short circuit, and that is something that's treatable with an ablation. And it's suppressible with medication. It sometimes can be fixed or completely, ablated, like gotten rid of with an ablation. But once it's there, it's sort of like the cat's out of the bag. Like a Dojolvi, I wouldn't expect. I mean, it's possible, but I would not, generally speaking, expect that it would just get better. But it depends on the type of SVT a little bit.
Okay. No, that's super helpful. That's super helpful. We have a couple more questions. Do you have a couple more minutes?
You bet.
Okay. So there are a couple of adult patients that are on here. And so one did ask, do you see adults? Do they have to already be and do you typically most of your patients, do they already have to be diagnosed with an FAOD or some form of condition that we kind of talked about earlier? Because I know that you see other metabolic conditions. So that was the first question I'll throw out. And then the second question is long. I'm going to try to consolidate it a little bit. This patient has a form has MCAD, but they're an adult and they're starting to have symptoms with palpitations and stuff at night. And so I think they're curious a little bit. They say that their cardiologist isn't concerned. I don't know if you've seen adult patients with MCAD with cardiac issues or have heard of that, if that's, I know it may not be something that's discussed in our community or not.
Yeah, so MCAD we generally consider to be lower risk for, I mean, the metabolism block is different, so there's the risk is not the same, but that's not to say that there may not be things that come up, especially in older patients, that we just don't know as much about because now we've got like Since newborn screening, we've just our diagnostic ability has gotten so much better. So, there may be things that we don't know. So I would, I would do the same thing for that individual that I do for anyone with palpitations, and monitor them and see, try and catch those symptoms when they're happening and see what it is to try and understand if it's pathologic or not. As for the do I follow adults? I mean, in general, no, but I kind of have a hard time letting go of my FAOD patients, so I have kept some into their early adulthood because I just can't help myself, and I don't know that they'll, they're stable, and I have a good partnership with my adult heart failure group. So if something came up, it wouldn't be an issue for me to get their help or for her to be admitted to the adult hospital. At some point, I'm going to have to, she's going to be better, or he is going to be better cared for by, an adult cardiologist, because I am not that, but I still am happy to maintain a partnership, just because there's not, many people on the adult side who are going to have an understanding of the metabolic issues. Most of the patients I see are diagnosed because everybody gets diagnosed by newborn screen, so that's usually how they get to me. Not to say that I wouldn't see somebody who doesn't have a diagnosis. Like, we certainly see some patients for workup and trying to sort out, with our usually with our mito clinic or the metabolic group. If they are sort of a mystery diagnosis, then I'll certainly work with my metabolic group, and who sees, adults as well.
So
But
it
I'm
sounds.
just a little more careful with adults and taking over their primary management if, as they get more complex, because I'm not an adult. I am a pediatric cardiologist, but I have a hard time letting go.
Because you're an amazing doctor. It's hard because I think from the patient side of things, right? You like it, the comfortability of a doctor that knows you. And I'm sure from a doctor standpoint too, like you love and care for your patients, but also recognize that an adult heart is a little bit different than a pediatric heart. And so collaboration is absolutely important. I realize that I missed a little part of this MCAD patient's question, so I do want to just see, but I think you kind of answered it. It sounds like that you would do similar kind of following, and that the pathology at this point, the understanding, we talked about the need for more energy for the heart. It could be a similar pathology based on the things that are known right now. Is that
Yeah, for sure. We don't know enough, because there's not enough research, especially in adults with FAODs, which, we hope that somebody will give us money to do more of that.
another patient said, I know several families who have chosen ICDs as our LCHAD kids are kids aged to young adults with cardiac changes. What are your thoughts on ICDs versus loop recorders?
So the loop recorder is just going to monitor. It's not going to, do anything. And the ICD is a device that will shock you if you have an arrhythmia. So in general, those are sort of decisions that are made on a case-by-case basis. If you have known risk for arrhythmia, like, certainly an ICD might be reasonable, because it will detect when you have arrhythmia. So it's watching, but it will, deliver a shock if you have an arrhythmia. If you've never had an arrhythmia before, in most places, it would be kind of controversial whether you would put an ICD in someone as, like, what we would call primary prevention, or in an individual who's never had an event. You sort of have to have some, you have to prove that they need it for some reason. So it's a little bit easier in adults, to some extent. It's harder in kids, because getting shocked is it can happen. Like, if you're like, with kids in, Wyoming or whatever, like in rural areas, who are like, who fall off their horse, or, something, they may have like an inappropriate discharge for some reason, or they're exercising, and that's, because they're good, but they're not perfect, and that's extremely traumatizing, to get an accidental shock. So it's not something you just do light, just without any thought, like, oh, it's totally safe, it's no problem, just do it. So there's lots of considerations, but for some patients who have, for example, if you have a fair amount of scar in the heart that you've proven by MRI and you have a proven history of having some dangerous arrhythmias, then absolutely, it would be reasonable to consider an ICD and use medication to try and prevent it from happening so you don't get shocked. But a loop recorder might be something that you do to watch a patient for a year or two so that you can really figure out what's going on before you take that step. So usually the loop would be something that would precede the ICD.
That's super helpful. We have a parent in here who I think has some questions, and I'm going to ask her to unmute because she couldn't figure out how to raise her hand. She put that in the chat and see if she can figure out how to. There you go, Angie.
Okay. You kind of touched on it earlier as far as like the troponin levels being muscle damage and prolonged QT syndrome kind of being linked to that. Have you seen many cases where it only presents during metabolic crisis?
Yes. Yes is the answer. And then it can
Okay.
get normal. Both can normalize.
And would you recommend a patient like that going on a beta blocker?
Probably. I mean, I like beta blockers. I think that they are, well tolerated, and they, the potential benefit outweighs the risk. So, I have a fairly low threshold to start beta blockers in my patients that have had any cardiac history. But that's not based on a consensus from like 100, metabolic physicians or cardiologists. It's my, specific practice. So it's not to say that what somebody else would, do is or my way is right or wrong, but I think that it's generally safe, and there may be reasons why a beta blocker would be an especially, good medication for a kid that has some cardiac, history of cardiomyopathy.
Okay, thank you. That's all I needed.
Another patient asked, do you like the use of Cardia? Cardia? I don't know.
Maybe I should pull up the chat. I'm not sure I know what they're referring to.
It's
Hey, Stephanie, it's Pam.
Oh,
And
perfect. Go ahead.
yeah.
Maybe I mispronounced it.
No, it's called Cardia. Our cardiologist recommended it for us to use because my daughter reacted to Zio and all of the other Holters.
Oh, okay.
If it's a similar type of monitoring, I'm sure it's very useful. But yeah, some people really have trouble with the adhesive and react to that. Like it's def that's definitely a problem. So like whatever you have to do to be able to, get some monitoring information, I think is definitely worthwhile. But I just don't have experience with that product because we generally have used our hospital uses Zio and just regular Holters.
Well, these are all amazing questions. I think we're getting closer to the end. I did want to go back to the patient that was exercising and just ask in regards to, he continued to exercise like through the cardiomyopathy as you guys found different strategies. Like as a cardiologist, how do you navigate exercise and cardiomyopathy and how do you figure that out as to how much is like too much or when it's not? Like how do you work with that? And caffeine, is that a bad idea? Like as we have teenagers and like is that something that we should encourage our kids to like stay away from, or if they're having issues with?
Everything there's I don't think there's evidence that it's particularly dangerous, but probably in excess, like drinking five, Red Bulls every day is not so good for your heart. So, like I think small amounts of caffeine in moderation is probably fine. As for exercising and it's you have to find a balance. Like if we don't want our kids and adults to not exercise and become overweight, and you need and for muscle issues and neuropathy and LCHAD, like exercise may be really important for preventing other complications. But I would just say I'd approach things in moderation, and it just is very case by case. Like if you had a somebody who was like some my patient that has more cardiac issues has been involved in some, rec sports, and it's been fine, but we've just had to make sure to support the calorie, needs of that patient. And maybe we'd be more likely to, do the overnight feeds and do pre-exercise Dojolvi and, timing some of those supplements with activity to, make it as safe as possible. So I think you have to, work with your team to kind of find a common ground for, what's best for, for your child. And there's always, you could potentially consider things like an exercise test and other things that would, help you get a little bit more information if it was, if it was safe for that particular patient.
Alex, I see your hand up. And then Zahid, I see your hand up.
Hey, I have a real quick question. I have a new physical therapist who started using my Apple Watch to track like my heart rate during exercise. Do you have like a general limit of what you'd want the heart rate to get to, like in your FOD patients with heart?
Well, I mean, that again, that's very individualized. So like it's you want to see, your heart rate is going to go up with from your baseline when you exercise. You may not want to be pushing yourself to maximal exertion on a, at all or on a regular basis. So that's generally it might be helpful to work with your with a cardiologist or with your physical therapist to kind of come up with some reasonable, limits to help you kind of gauge when you need to take a break. So you don't get into trouble, or have symptoms. So that's kind of an individual thing. There's not you, there's that would be my approach if it were my own patient, is just trying to find a, some parameters that make sense for you. What was your other question? The other part of that question? So exercise like heart rate parameters. Oh, your Apple Watch. Those are those can be useful. I just Apple Watches can sometimes pick up some abnormalities that we don't know that are always like real. So every once in a while we just get some weird data from an Apple Watch. So just take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. And if you're having any symptoms, then what I would advise is that you maybe wear Zio while you're doing your mild or moderate exercise, so that or your monitor, so that we could someone could see what your heart rate's doing when you're actually doing activity.
Go ahead, Zahid.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Chatfield. I just had two questions. One's like a research-based question. When you talked about the remodeling, there's like a reversal you talked about earlier that sometimes the myopathy can remodel back to a normal heart. Is there like a working hypothesis on how that occurs? And is that specific to FAOD, or is that just like a general observation?
It can happen in FAOD, and it can happen in other mitochondrial disorders, that there can be like a, I mean, there's probably some compensatory hypertrophy that happens with stress or with metabolic energy deficit. And then if when your energy is restored, that reverse remodeling can occur. Whether that happens, so that happens in kids, and maybe kids have a greater capacity for reverse remodeling in that in the context of metabolic disease. But what happens in adults, like I don't really know, because I don't take care of adults, but also it hasn't been studied. So it's something that's very that's more based on my experiences is much more notable in FAOD, but it's certainly something that you can see this like a potential for reverse remodeling and kids with mitochondrial disorder when they're get back to a well state or they're treated medically, what have you.
And then my second question is a little more clinical related. And I know you're a pediatric cardiologist, but what is the role in like heart transplants and caring for patients with FAOD? And is because I, from my understanding, that diet is a very important intervention to manage FAOD. Can a patient that's keeping up to date with their diet, making sure they're taking it seriously to the best of their abilities, is that a satisfactory enough to keep them away from needing a heart transplant in the future?
Yeah, so there's some patients that most of this is based on like what I know from Dr. Buckley and Gillingham, who and Pittsburgh has probably done more heart transplants and FAOD patients than they're a big heart trans pediatric heart transplant center, but they're also a big referral center for FAOD. So it just so happens that more of them have been, done there. So since Dojolvi, I think we've seen that there are more patients who have recovered. But probably, there's some patients who just have had so much damage, myocardial damage, that they have end stage heart failure that they don't recover. So they end up on VADs, just like other patients might. And we would take the same approach as trying to support them nutritionally and with, antibiotic therapy. And I'm guessing Dr. Vockley probably has experienced. I'm not sure if anyone has actually been separated from a VAD with therapy. It's certainly conceivable, but that can happen in pediatric heart failure as well. But there's some patients who've just probably had so much damage that they have terminal, what we term terminal heart failure, and don't recover. And so, they're treated the same way as other, heart failure patients in pediatrics. They either end up on a VAD or they end up on milrinone in the hospital and they wait for transplant. And in general, as long as they don't have, as long as the heart is the primary problem and you know that, heart replacement is going to fix that problem, and then they have to be supported through the transplant period, because transplant is very energy, requiring. So they definitely have, patients with FAO do have risk for rhabdo during the heart transplant period. They're in the operating room, they have to be NPO. They have to get steroids oftentimes after transplant, and those factors are very catabolic. So it just the teams that have managed some of those patients just have to be very attentive to providing adequate, calories to support them through transplant. But it definitely can be done. So and generally, FAOD, there's no reason why, you're generally healthy, compliant, patient with FAOD, wouldn't be a heart transplant candidate, and a number have when they have not re been able to recover. So I hope that answers the question.
No, that was very enlightening. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chatfield, and thank you for staying with us for an extra half an hour. I know we had a lot of questions, so I really, really appreciate your extra time. And thank you, everyone, for coming tonight and all of the questions that you guys shared and asked and had. We really appreciate everyone taking the time to join us tonight and look forward to seeing everyone soon. Hope you have a wonderful evening.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.